Good morning. I'm calling to order this meeting in the House Workforce, Labor, and Economic Development Finance and Policy Committee. I represent Dave Pinto along with Dave Baker, my co-chair. We have got one bill we're going to address fairly quickly and then have a discussion about artificial intelligence in the workforce, an important topic. We'll start with our minutes, and Chair Baker, if you're willing to move approval of our minutes from March 12th.
March 12th minutes as approved or so presented, Mr. Chair, I'd like to move for approval.
Thank you, Chair Baker. Members, we do have a quorum. Any additions or corrections to those minutes? Seeing none, all in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? Okay. Motion passes. Our minutes are adopted. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And so, members, the first bill up is House File 1316. We heard this bill and actually amended it in 2025 on April 3rd. There was an amendment that was adopted at that time, the A3 amendment. We are making sure that that amendment is on our committee website just for clarity, but the April 3rd, 2025 meeting minutes will reflect that the bill was amended at that time. I'm going to ask, and Chair Frazier, if you're willing to move House File 1316 to bring that before us, I would appreciate that.
So moved, Mr. Chair.
Thank you so much. So House File 1316, as previously amended, is before us. This is Representative Curran's bill. Representative Curran, you have an additional amendment, the A4, which looks like it just updates dates. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Okay. So, members, let's get the bill updated to be the correct date. And so, Chair Frazier, if you're willing to move the A4 amendment as well, appreciate that.
So moved, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Chair Frazier. Members, any questions about the A4? Again, just updating dates. So, seeing none, all in favor of approval of the A4, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Okay. That passes. So House File 1316 was previously amended. We've added an additional amendment. And so, Representative Curran, if you could just remind us about the bill. And members, we had a full discussion and presentation on this bill on April 3rd, 2025. So the plan is just to have a short discussion now and then hoping to move it along. Representative Curran, if you can describe House File 1316, please.
Yes, thank you so much, Chair and committee members, for bringing us back to House File 1316 as amended. So that folks know, the largest change in that amendment that's really important to note is that we removed the definition of independent contractor, and we also changed the requirements of the documents that are required. Those were a couple of points that stakeholders had pointed out that we fixed with that last amendment. Otherwise, House File 1316 essentially ensures that parents with child support obligations are reporting the income that they're receiving so that children can adequately benefit from the wages that they're making per court orders.
Thank you, Representative Curran. And I should note that the plan is to send this to the General Register, and so we'll make sure that the motion reflects that. Members, are there questions or discussions regarding House File 1316 as amended? And Chair, Representative Greenman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Curran, and I really appreciate the work that you did on this and the amendment. I just have a quick question for DLI to make sure that it confirms with my understanding, which is once we removed the definition, what it means is independent contractor, the definition would be the test that we currently have in statute.
And it looks like you're phone a friend here. If you can please identify yourself, Mr. Moore, and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Josiah Moore, Legislative Director at Labor and Industry. And thanks, Rep. Greenman, for the question. Striking that definition of independent contractor will make it more clear that we are not relying on that definition, and we can just rely on the tests that DLI has in law for our purposes, and of course, the UI tests that exist elsewhere and other applicable tests.
Okay, thank you, Representative Greenman. That looks like that's all. Representative Greenman, yeah.
Thank you, and I really appreciate this. I think that it is really important when people are classified correctly that they are paying their child support, and I know that that's what this bill does. So thank you again. Thanks for the assist, and thank you, Representative Curran.
Thank you, Representative Greenman. We'll see if there's anything else. Doesn't look like there is. Representative Curran, we'll give you the final word on your bill.
I appreciate the support.
Thank you so much. And so Chair Frazier's motion is to recommend House File 1316 as amended to be placed on the General Register. All in favor of that motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? Oh, okay. Congratulations. House File 1316 as amended is on its way. Thank you, Representative Curran. And we will now be proceeding to our series of presentations and discussion about a couple of proposals relating to artificial intelligence and our workforce. And first up is the University of Minnesota, some folks from there. And so once you get settled in, if you can please identify yourself and proceed with your presentation, and welcome to you.
Identifying myself as Dr. Jim.
Yeah. Hello. If you can just please say your name and your affiliation, and then you can proceed.
My name is Dr. James Wilgenbusch, and my affiliation is with the University of Minnesota.
Great. Please. Yeah. Thank you.
Good morning. Genevieve Melton-Mukes. I'm from the University of Minnesota, professor of surgery, senior associate dean for health informatics and data science.
And whomever will be going first, once you, I guess we're getting your presentation up, it looks like still, perhaps. And I will note, we have your presentation in our packet, I believe, and also online for folks watching, so we could always go through it that way. Yeah. Okay.
Wonderful. Yeah. Good morning.
Good morning.
And happy St. Patrick's Day. Thank you to Chair Pinto, Baker, and members of the committee for the opportunity to be here this morning. I am joined here by my colleague, Dr. Jim Wilgenbusch, and sending his regrets is Dr. Galen Jones, Professor of Statistics and our inaugural Vice Provost for AI. I'm going to begin by providing a few opening remarks. As we all know, AI is highly transformative. It's being disruptive, and it's rapidly evolving. And it has growing implications for our economy, workforce, and daily lives. Even during this important time, Minnesota is really well positioned if we act with alacrity and smartly to lead in this space. We benefit from a very strong concentration of Fortune 500 companies, a vibrant startup ecosystem, a highly educated workforce, and a land-grant R1 university that's committed to advancing responsible AI innovation. And this conversation is not solely about the University of Minnesota. Our goal and vision, as I'm going to cover over the next several slides, is to strengthen the broader statewide AI ecosystem across industry, government, higher education, and communities throughout Minnesota. And this is going to be something that we have to, when we think about AI, do together. This has to be collaborative across sectors because the scale and complexity of this work is far greater than any single organization can manage alone. So we're going to share much of what's been going on through the university, but everything we present today really has to be grounded in this larger statewide vision and a commitment to ensuring that all Minnesotans benefit from AI-driven innovation. While OpenAI launched ChatGPT only 3 years ago, we're clearly seeing that AI is rapidly changing our lives, and it's done so overnight. And this isn't hyperbole. A year ago, a Nature article stated that 40% of our lives are already impacted by AI. And more recent reports suggest that this can be over 50% in some sectors, and the pace is rapidly increasing. AI is much more than generative AI that we think about with chatbots like ChatGPT, Claude, or Gemini. It's impacting material science, agriculture, health sciences, and of course, everyday life, amongst other areas. It's already easy to see how artificial intelligence is affecting our professional lives. As others may have noted, AI is changing how we learn, work, and plan our careers. For students, for instance, AI can support career exploration, personalized learning, new ways of understanding complex material. In the workplace, AI is being used to draft onboarding materials, help managers draft marketing strategies, and increasingly, It assists us in executing intelligent tools in technology. It's supporting code development, sometimes called vibe coding, as well as creating design mock-ups and early prototypes. From conversations with Minnesota businesses, we're hearing from some of our more, from focus groups, that there are more immediate productivity gains, and this is often coming from junior employees or others that are really becoming fluent in AI. And this highlights the importance of workforce readiness as these technologies and solutions continue to evolve. What may be less well known is the foundational role that the University of Minnesota has played in AI and computing. The university is home to some of the largest national academic data sets. These are essentially public resources for next generation AI. Minnesota also has a long history of leadership in high-performance computing, from the nation's first university supercomputing center and Seymour Cray, who's the father of supercomputing, to the Gopher protocol, which helped lay the foundation for the internet. This is combined with faculty that have led in several areas. You may consider this good or bad, recommender systems that underpin things like Amazon and social media, as well as important national recognized commitment to interdisciplinary research. These strengths provide a powerful foundation for continued leadership in AI innovation. Here are a couple of examples of how the university has been innovating. We are one of 20 National Science Foundation funded AI institutes. There's an initiative called AI LEAF, and this focuses on making agriculture carbon negative. At our Center for Learning Health System Sciences, we're recognized nationally for leading responsible evaluation of AI in clinical practice, including solutions that help to detect and treat conditions like sepsis earlier and more effectively. We are also addressing one of the more critical challenges of AI, including energy consumption. And there's material science research that's now continuing to develop novel technologies for memory, which will reduce the energy consumption by orders of magnitude, somewhere around 1,000 to 200 or 2,500 times below current levels. Finally, we have a growing and really recognized culture of interdisciplinary collaboration. And this is underpinned by ethical and responsible use of AI. Over the past year, the University of Minnesota across all its campuses has intentionally developed a strategic roadmap across all the campuses with AI embedded throughout. First, the roadmap focuses on preparing students to be fully engaged and effective participants in Minnesota's workforce, civic life, and global economy. Second, it emphasizes transforming learning. And AI is already changing how we teach and how students learn, increasing both the pace and need for continuous education. Traditional approaches alone are no longer sufficient. As we go forward, learning will increasingly need to be adaptable, continuous, and tailored. And my standing in front of the classroom with a whiteboard will not be how we do all our teaching in the future. A third pillar centers on the university's broad impact in service to communities across the state. The remaining pillars focus on advancing research and innovation and on strengthening the university's workforce, operations, and facilities, areas in which AI will play a substantial and enabling role. Taken together, this roadmap reflects a comprehensive approach to ensuring AI's strengths, education, research, and public service across Minnesota. So we're thrilled to launch the university's AI hub, and this is evolved from our former data science and AI hub. This is a strategic unit that is designed to advance our AI vision by coordinating, supporting, and elevating AI efforts across the university and throughout Minnesota. The AI hub focuses on three core areas: teaching and learning, research and innovation, and outreach and coordination as a convening hub. The key priority is active engagement and with the community and industry partners to help build a strong, collaborative, and thriving AI ecosystem that benefits the entire state. So to do this, The AI hub will focus on several high-level priorities. I'm going to describe those in more detail in the following slides. But again, it is focused on making us a hub, education and upskilling, driving innovation and discovery. And as a hub, this translates importantly into capabilities to facilitate access to resources and expertise, providing guidance to partners and stakeholders, and clearly communicating the impacts and benefits of AI across the state. Also importantly, at our core, the AI hub is grounded in a strong commitment to responsible and ethical AI. This principle guides all our work. We embed equity, bias, mitigation, accessibility across our curriculum, technologies, and AI initiatives to ensure that the tools serve everyone fairly. We prioritize human oversight and critical thinking, uphold academic integrity, in research and teaching, and build AI fluency across learners, faculty, and staff. And finally, we invest in strong governance, secure infrastructure, and clear policies to maintain and earn the public trust. And these commitments form the foundation. So what does it mean to be a global and statewide AI hub? It means building an AI ecosystem spanning sectors and providing shared value across the state and beyond. So just to demonstrate some of the activities, this is the second year that we hosted the Women in AI and Data Science Conference. This engaged more than 800 attendees across academia and industry, and extending our reach into community spaces, supporting public learning and engagement through community forums. We're also collaborating actively with state government. You can see in the middle picture, Senator Champion, who recently visited campus. We want to extend an invitation to anyone here who wishes to come to campus and see what we're doing. We're happy to show you around and show you things like what's in the room in the picture, which is something called the AI Makerspace. It's a room on campus where there is equipment, facilitators set up, and anyone who comes in can say, I want to get help getting started and learn about AI in a low-stakes environment and safe environment. It's also a place where groups can come. We've had several administrative groups come to solve work challenges together using AI, and we have hopes of expanding this model more broadly. And as the hub comes together, we're excited to serve as that central convener, positioning the university and Minnesota in this broader AI community. As noted earlier, the AI hub will play a critical role in shaping the future of education, an area that's already rapidly evolving and central both to the university's mission and Minnesota's long-term success. Over the past 2 years, we've launched early efforts such as before I spoke about the AI makerspaces, industry partnered upskilling programs, including a recent DEED program training Phillips and Mayo employees, and continuing to support K through 12 summer camps for Minnesota high school students to build AI readiness. And with additional investment, the hub will expand AI literacy, offer discipline-specific training, support interdisciplinary programs, and lead workforce upskilling efforts, ensuring that students, workers, and communities across Minnesota are prepared to thrive. The AI hub will accelerate research and discovery across the university, forming new innovative partnerships, including with industry, by enabling high impact interdisciplinary innovation. We're building on a strong foundation, including our AI and data science seed grant program and a number of AI convenings that foster early collaboration. For example, this past year, we hosted a computer vision and AI workshop with Honeywell, and that has continued to develop ongoing partnerships. And so new investment here will help us compete for major interdisciplinary AI grants, strengthen team-based, multi-institutional, and industry research impact. By doing this, we'll also have cutting-edge AI tools, computing, data resources, and make strategic investments in AI expertise. Together, this will help us create a collaborative research ecosystem that will accelerate not only discovery and extramural funding, but spin off new startups, and collaborative ideas with industry to amplify Minnesota and the university's impact. An important concrete example of something that occurred earlier this year was leading a delegation to NVIDIA at the end of January. I want to thank Representative Baker and Senator Champion again for participating in that visit, as well as leaders from a range of companies, including Ecolab, Cargill, Medtronic, Northwind, Honeywell, Greater MSP, and others, and my apologies for those that I missed. We had a day-long event, which personally I don't think could have gone any better, because we saw together the potential that can come from partnership between us. And I'll point out the gentleman in the white shirt in the middle of the picture, Chris Malachowski. He's one of the co-founders of NVIDIA. He spent the entire afternoon with us talking about what he calls his 50 States Initiative. It's the idea of bringing together significant infrastructure, training, and strategic investments to each state in the area of AI. This is one way that we're trying to achieve national leadership. In the case of Mr. Malachowski, he provided a $50 million gift to the University of Florida, which was mostly equipment, and there was investment as well as throughout the state. And this was amplified by the state and other investments. Similarly, in New York, through its Empire AI initiative and support from the Simons Foundation and Tom Secunda, a co-founder of Bloomberg, to Cornell, Utah has another initiative, which was funded in part by the Huntsman family and state funding, bringing resources, training, and infrastructure to the state. And not surprisingly, we want to position Minnesota similarly with software infrastructure, cyber infrastructure, and training resources. And, you know, I think just in retroflexion, this, you know, quite valuably, overall, the most important thing probably was the opportunity to have important conversations together across all of these different stakeholders and considering what might be necessary for Minnesota's success. We have several follow-ups, including engaging companies, other educational institutions across all of higher education, and also thinking about how to position Minnesota and think about what our moonshot and focus should be for the state. We have many strengths in various sectors, and we list manufacturing materials and industrial automation, med tech, agriculture and food science, but there's many others as well. And so just in follow-up, in late April, we'll be hosting NVIDIA for further dialogue. Please look for the invite, and we'll be thrilled to host you and have you as a part of this dialogue. So in closing, our overarching goal is to build this thriving AI ecosystem, and we want to build this hub of industry, academic innovation, upskilling, and collaboration to shape the future of Minnesota responsibly and ethically in AI. And with that, I'd like to thank you for the opportunity to present, and we look forward to the discussion and your questions.
Thank you so much. Thanks for your work. We'll see if there are, Representative Johnson, we'll go to you. Johnson W.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair. Thank you for the presentation. Mm-hmm. Just have a couple questions. Where would you say the U is sitting right now as far as what you're doing and what you're doing with AI compared to what is going on in other institutions throughout the country?
And Dr. Melton Mukes?
Thank you, Representative Johnson. I would like to say that the university is poised, and we have some reasonable long-standing historic investment in things like research computing. Jim Wilgenbush, who sits beside me, leads our Minnesota Supercomputing Institute. But the pace of things like computing, some of the expertise and investments that are being put in this space are not at the same level as many R1 institutions at this point. And that is one of the reasons that this has become something that's front and center in the university's AI strategic or university strategic plan. It's not the AI strategic plan, it's the university strategic plan. So I would say we have the opportunity right now, but we're not yet positioned as some of the other states have positioned themselves.
President Johnson.
Yep. Thank you. One more question. Thank you for that answer. One more question is, what is the relationship in your mind as far as data centers to advancement of AI? In other words, there's been a reluctance for data centers in Minnesota. Do you see that affecting what your goals are?
Would you like to speak?
Dr. Wilgenbusch?
Chair Pico, Chair Baker, and committee members, that's an excellent question. We are, as a state, really well positioned. Obviously, today is a very good example of the ambient cooling potential for data centers to do it energy efficiently and so forth is important. I think there are strategic opportunities in our state to specifically align with industry and academia on the development of data centers that would benefit the state long term. So what impact would that have, I think, is something that we need to consider, certainly because the state has many other important priorities, namely the environment. And so looking at the impact specifically on a case-by-case basis is something that we've advocated for and I think is important to consider.
Do you want to speak to the level of energy,
but for... the one more component is that we right now, as we've noticed, are in a race as far as gaining sort of market share and foothold in this key technology that is not only important for the state, but also for the nation. I think what we've seen in other technologies, people can remember certainly when computing came to fruition, that the efficiency of those technologies gained significant ground. We are already seeing that, not only in terms of the materials, as we mentioned, as Dr. Genevieve Melton Mukes mentioned, we have developed materials that are significantly able to improve energy efficiency, but also the algorithms themselves are allowing us to improve model training significantly. And we expect to see that in the future, which I think will lessen the demands around data centers and energy.
And Representative Johnson.
Thank you. Just so I'm clear in my head, because we have a lot of discussions regarding data centers, In order for you to reach the goals that you've achieved, will we need more data centers built in Minnesota?
Dr. Wilgenbusch, sure.
That's a hard question for me to answer, Senators Chair Pico and Chair Baker. It's a good question. I think it's something that we should look at carefully. But right now, I just don't have that data.
Okay.
Thank you. Chair Baker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And again, I want to thank my friends at the University of Minnesota for coming forward today and for talking about this important issue. My ability to attend that day, that very long day in San Jose, was really helpful for me to better understand. And what was unique about what I heard from Chris, who is with us, the co-founder of NVIDIA, and the headquarters partners that were with us along with the university, was that our collaboration was something that they had not seen before like this. We had a couple of sitting legislators, headquarter companies, which in Minnesota, we have such a high number of them per capita here. It's a gift that I think we sometimes forget. I think that it was something different. I think I learned a lot about how we need to expand the education of what is the best of what AI has to come, and also understanding the guardrails that are needed to make sure we protect our jobs, but also just know that there's more jobs around this that will be, I think, added on to this. But what did come up a number of times was just making sure that we had a global package, you know, sort of like not only involved with some, you know, economic development incentives so that when headquarter companies or smaller companies want to grow in Minnesota, we don't make it more risky in Minnesota to do those same kind of research and development projects to try to grow and learn. Again, just visiting with, I think, our friends at Cargill about trying to get more meat off the bone. It was talking about just those little tiny issues that they're trying to do so that they can do the very best that they can, and they need these sensors. It was listening to the person from Duluth that was working on the drones and the things in the Lake Superior where things were not working properly for folks around the country or around the world because they weren't tested in cold water and the freezing. And just the awareness and the ability for us to bring a lot of this kind of thing here to Minnesota, I just really walked away from there looking at the opportunities that way. But again, in the same sense, we need to really be careful about how we want to proceed with protecting not only our jobs, but also just our growth with our larger companies that really have the ability to put in a lot of private capital. And that's what's going to make this thing work. So I appreciate your work on this, your partnership with us, and I look forward to a lot more of this. So thank you for coming today. Thanks, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Chair Baker. Representative Kozlowski.
Thanks, Chair Pinto, our testifiers for coming to the committee here. I appreciate the conversation and the questions that were already raised. And so I'll just kind of riff on that. But, you know, I heard you say it's a race. And I think with AI and being in a landscape in Minnesota where we have yet to pass a single law on touching anything with AI, that it can also feel like a race to the top for certain folks, and particularly billionaires, in a race to the bottom for workers, especially, and for planet. You know, I heard you say about the cooling and technologies, and I think those are things in Minnesota that we're trying to figure out, how to balance having good-paying, livable jobs that, you know, also don't take away and undermine rights. But those technologies still also discharge chemicals into the environment, for example, into the water systems. And so I just more curious kind of on the AI question in general of like balancing what you're seeing with AI and some of the gains that we're able to make in workplaces, in business and other industries with that of just the ethics of AI in general, given that Minnesota lacks, you know, comprehensive review on public health, on water, on what it's doing to workers' rights and those kind of things. Can you just speak more broadly to what the university's role is in both advancing this technology, but then also making sure that it is a technology that is ultimately responsible back to Minnesotans?
Dr. Melton Hughes.
Thank you, Representative Kozlowski. Those are great questions. And I think and the university has a primary role there, definitely. And that is the main reason that ethics and responsible AI is the underpinning and foundation for all of this work. And, you know, I think that, you know, when we look at things like the Humphrey policy work and everything, there will be a huge thrust in that area. And looking at things like public health, where we have an amazing foundation. This is a very pivotal time when we have a federal government right now that is asking to deregulate AI at a local level, a state level at least. We have to make some decisions in the state how we wish to approach that. So it's a huge challenge and opportunity that we have ahead of us.
Representative Kozlowski, anything else? Yeah.
Sure. Thank you, Chair Pinto, and to the testifiers for that. You know, I think in the similar way of what with copper nickel mining and what it's doing to wild rice beds and those things, we see the university kind of in this place where it's really looking at all the different factors and not necessarily taking aim in a particular direction. So with AI and with just the underpinning of this industry and so much, I would hope the university is continuing to take a similar approach. I spoke with some university staff, folks in higher education. We had a number of higher ed staff on the Hill. We had nurses coming to the Capitol recently, and they all spoke about kind of some of the challenges and the headwinds that they're facing in workplace. And I know a lot of this is geared around some of the benefits and gains for employers. And I'm curious what you're seeing in this new era around, for example, they mentioned that the AI could actually be used to set their worker schedules, to set pay, and it could actually, what you're offered as one worker compared to another worker could be different. And so in that way, it could be exploitative or bite into their collective bargaining rights. For higher education staff, I heard them talk about testing out some of the AI tools and being kind of both excited, but also the ways that they're seeing that the information that the AI is producing is misleading or wrong. And so just curious, like, as the university's moving through those aspects, I'll say also for students, we've heard stories of ChatGPTs where students are chatting with them and they're in mental health crisis, and instead of directing that person to a trained, accredited person who can actually support them, gives them really terrible guidance, and we've seen really negative, harmful outcomes. And so just curious, like, how the university or what you're seeing some of the headwinds that have yet to be overcome with AI as we're developing policies at the state legislature. Thank you.
Dr. Melton Mukes.
Thank you for that question. And it was multifold. High level, these are definitely headwinds. The guardrails that are put around these technologies and solutions are incredibly important. We know that, there have been prominent cases where using a chatbot in cases of mental health crisis has had some terrible consequences. We know that. We also know that solutions that are built well, there is some evidence that some of these solutions can help folks at scale be treated for mental health conditions and really do so in a way that today there's not enough therapists out there that can be there for patients at all times. And we know that that will be a very, we believe and have some evidence now that that will be the case. So it does go back to those pieces about responsible and ethical use of AI. If we were to take business practices, there are certainly cases where people will take advantage of folks, and putting in those fair safeguards has to happen. And I think that's some of the reason that some of this early legislation is being talked about later in this session. But I think that's the overall thinking. If we let AI go wild, that is not going to be to the benefit for our society. So.
Okay, Representative Kozlowski. Okay, thank you. Representative Greenman, you'll go to you last.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I want to follow up on Representative Kozlowski's questions, because, you know, as we talk about AI and the technology, it's value neutral, right? It's a tool. What really matters is who controls the model, who decides how it progresses and how it develops, and who benefits from the technology. And I'm wondering, we've heard a lot of conversations about with industry, a lot of the biggest companies in the state and the world. I'm wondering, as you, as the hub, and as the U specifically engages in this, what conversations and commitments has the U asked for or made about the sort of the ethics and responsibility is a big word that doesn't mean much if we don't put meat on the bones. So I'm wondering if there's any commitments or conversations that are happening at the U around these bigger conversations.
Dr. Melton Mukes.
So Representative Greenman, thank you for that question. So there are definitely discussions. The AI hub is quite frankly in the stage of forming. We were announced a week and a half ago officially. So and we are in the process of looking at what those investments will look like and what that will mean specifically around the area that you're talking about, ethics and responsible AI, and that may mean faculty hires. That obviously means practices that we will be bringing forward and policies, et cetera. To your point overall, I happen to practice in healthcare. I'm a surgeon, and we look at, say, the nursing workforce. A lot of places are very much saying, you know, don't put any tool in unless nursing is part of the decision making behind any tool that goes into clinical care, because it needs to work for us. It needs to make sense for patient care, and certainly having patients' voices in the middle of it. But that is absolutely key to the work that happens.
Representative Greenman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm interested, and again, sort of in the work of the U and the hub, because again, we are not right now the ones controlling how the models are developed. In many cases, the models are not disclosed and they're kept private when AI companies actually draw red lines. We don't know. We don't have any regulatory way of knowing whether they're actually living up to those obligations and commitments. And so I guess what I would ask is, and this is just my, as you engage this conversation, you know, Pew said 6 in 10 Minnesotans, or 6 in 10 Americans would like more control on how AI is used. Only 17% think that they have control. I guess my question is, using the power of the U and how we engage, what specific policies are you developing and considering, not just in your conversations with these tools, but as it relates to state and federal policy, that will do some of the things that you're talking about? Because I think if we don't put some, if we ask for guardrails and we still don't have any oversight or power, what we're doing is basically having a conversation with a brick wall.
Dr. Mountain Ukes.
So thank you for that question and comment. You know, so I don't know if I have the full answer here, but I certainly hear your point that putting meat on the bones behind this is really, really important. I can tell you in, say, areas of healthcare, there are several leaders that are thinking about how do we create reproducibility, transparency, how do we version around that? And certainly, you know, if we look more broadly at the landscape of AI, you know, there is definitely folks that are very much saying we need a lot more transparency behind it. It is both an opportunity as well as, I would say, a big challenge when these tools that are so powerful do need companies and commercial sort of interests to create these huge models. We could not do this alone with any like single academic place. It needs to feed off of data, quite frankly, and it needs for some of these larger, very powerful models, absolutely needs to have commercial backing, and that presents challenges over time. So certainly this ability to, for instance, have benchmarks, which is something that we certainly are very interested in from an academic perspective, to be able to say how well does something work in a particular setting, is something that we've talked a lot about, and being able to be a third party that's trusted to be able to say where it works, where it doesn't. And the other thing that we're learning is, in some instances, you don't need the huge data model. You can do it in a much more concentrated way and have much more control about that. And I think the future will have more of that. That may not sound like something that's accessible to everybody today, but I do think we're going to see a future where folks are going to be able to say, I'd like to be able to do this, pull these things together, and have more control around it.
I don't know if you want to... Okay. Yeah, Dr. Wilgenbusch.
Here, Pico. The question is an excellent one. In some ways, it comes down to regulating the technology versus regulating the impact. The U has been very focused on the impact portion. We have values that the AI hub will not deviate from, and that sort of people-centered component of it is the guiding principle for which we're really building, if you will, the AI hub itself. So the technology evolves rapidly. It's happening right now. Fortunately, the U is a big part of it. Dr. Milton Mukes mentioned something called knowledge-guided machine learning, which we think is sort of the next step, where, for example, we integrate basic physical principles around machine learning models to put on, in some ways, those guardrails so that reality, the physical principles that we understand the universe operates on, actually are those guardrails in cases specifically around things that involve medicine or materials, the way that jet aircraft are developed and so forth. And so that knowledge-guided machine learning is a way forward that actually puts on guardrails in an algorithmic way. But looking again at the impacts and legislating those impacts, I think, is the important distinction that we've put forward.
Okay, Representative Greenman, yeah, we should wrap
Thank
up pretty
you.
Quick.
Yep. Yeah. Just last question. I think that, and I appreciate that, and I'd like to see as the EU engages, I think if you don't regulate technology, you won't control the impact. You can't. And I think we're seeing that in all sorts of technology and, frankly, over the history of this country. And so I think that thinking that we could have a technology that's developing in private, in most cases, with, and you talked about the large data sets, which we're seeing a consolidation of that. And so it's less and less companies who are controlling more and more of that. And the idea that that could all develop and that the public focus would be on that impact, I think, is naive at best. And so I would like to see, as we're thinking about how we think about disclosure, how we think about when we are using, and especially when we're talking about public investment and engagement, but these are all companies and these are all technologies that are absolutely benefiting from both public investment and also the public infrastructure. And then the other thing I just would really like to see the next time you come in here is the consultation with the broader public. So small businesses, I've been working on a lot on surveillance pricing, which really is really hard for small businesses because the big businesses are using that giant data set that they are accumulating in and oftentimes merging for in order to drive up prices, and it is actually really hurting small businesses. We've heard that. I'd like to see engagement with workers and also just the general public. And so, you know, I think it is great that you're talking to, and oftentimes we see photos with NVIDIA and, again, the largest companies in the world, but I would like to see photos with the general public who are going to be impacted, and as you talked about, the impact of this is already changing the way people do things. And so it's really important that that's not siloed into a different public policy school or whatever, but that's central to that conversation. So I'm really hoping that develops as you move forward.
Representative,
completely
agree with that. And if we did not emphasize enough the community engagement, that definitely is an oversight. We have gone to multiple community forums. If you have folks that are interested, we're also willing to go there. We're willing to drive. And, you know, I would say as well, the small businesses are definitely an emphasis. A lot of the DEED grant money so far has been a little bit more med tech focused in how the AI training is being deployed. But we certainly have a vision, and I think folks are interested in how we can expand that. And small businesses have to be a part of it, absolutely.
Good, thank you so much. So appreciate you being here. We're gonna move on to our next presentation. Thanks for your work. If you can follow up with us on those community aspects that Representative Greenman was talking about, and we'll be aware of you as a resource. Thank you. So Aaron Rosenthal from Restore Policy Action, if you can make your way up. And once you get settled in, I'll ask you to identify yourself and proceed. I will note that we've got a report in our packets and on online, reporting some documents as well. A joint report, it looks like, from North Star Policy Action, the University of St. Thomas, talking about the impact of generative AI in the Minnesota job market. And get your presentation up. There's also a one-pager with us as well. And again, members of the public, I believe these are all online on our website.
All righty. Thank you.
Please.
Co-Chair Pinto, Co-Chair Baker, members, for the record, I'm Aaron Rosenthal. I'm the research director at North Star Policy Action, We are a think tank dedicated to improving the lives of working Minnesotans. I am so glad that this committee is talking about this issue today. We are, I think, on the precipice of a 21st century industrial revolution, and we are, as a state, woefully unprepared to meet the moment. I want to start by talking a little bit about context and capacity of AI. The previous presentation mentioned how rapidly this technology is advancing. If we look back about a year and a half ago, frontier models of generative AI were beating out industry experts around 10% of the time. Fast forward a little over a year, it was closer to 40% of the time that generative models were beating industry experts, and some models like Claude are pretty close to 50%, which means when it comes to frontier generative AI models, they are at parity, roughly, with what industry experts can produce. As capacity rises, so too does adoption. Not surprisingly, companies are increasingly finding these tools useful. If we look back to 2017, about 20% of US companies were utilizing AI. That's closer to 80% today. Generative AI, things like ChatGPT and Claude and Gemini, which really came on the scene in 2023, we see about a third of companies utilizing that 2 years ago. Today, again, closer to 80%. So capacity adoption is rising quickly. As that happens, what we're seeing is a more and more anxious workforce. So if we look at what are people's concerns about AI, and people have a lot of concerns about AI, things around misinformation, privacy, but the number one concern is how AI will impact people's jobs. That is where people are most concerned, and this is not a partisan issue. I don't know of another issue where Republicans and Democrats seem more aligned in the general public on the idea that AI is a concerning thing. They are more concerned than excited about this. And again, it looks the same for Democrats and Republicans. Now, this isn't just about workers being concerned about AI taking their job. That is obviously part of the concern. But there are also particular areas where workers are expressing anxiety. One of them is in AI making important decisions, things like a hiring decision, for example, where AI is deciding who gets a job. Another is in surveillance, the degree to which AI is being used to monitor workers and track their movements while at their job. So as we've seen, workers are increasingly anxious, and in response to that anxiety, they are asking for the government to do something. There are overwhelming majorities of Americans who have said that they want to see greater regulation of AI, and importantly, even if it means slowing down AI innovation. Now, I want to state that I'm of the belief that we don't need to see these two as in competition with each other. AI innovation does not need to be in opposition to AI regulation. I firmly believe that we can actually regulate in AI in a way that allows AI innovation to continue. But it's telling, I think, that people are saying, even if it means slowing down AI, we want to see more regulations in place. Despite these calls from people to see more government intervention, we are seeing relative legislative inactivity. In Minnesota, as you'll see on this slide, we've passed a few pieces of legislation related to AI, though nothing in relation to the workforce, which again is why it's particularly exciting to see a hearing in this committee on this topic. By contrast, other states have done more. If you look at Illinois, close to us in the Midwest, they have passed several pieces of legislation on AI and labor. But again, this is not a Democrat and Republican issue. Texas has passed substantially more AI legislation than the state of Minnesota has passed. Now, the study that we did on AI in relation to the Minnesota workforce asked a relatively simple question. This was with Dr. Rege, who's the director for the Center of Applied AI at St. Thomas. And we looked at how many workers in Minnesota have high exposure to generative AI, which meant generative AI could do 50% or more of their job. And when we ask that simple question, what we find is that roughly a third of Minnesota workers, over 800,000 people in Minnesota, are in these high gen AI exposure jobs. If we look at very high exposure, where generative AI could do 75% or more of a worker's job, it's a little over 100,000 workers in that position. This makes Minnesota the most vulnerable workforce in the Midwest and the 10th most vulnerable workforce in the country. What that means is that Minnesota workers are disproportionately in jobs where generative AI is threatening, where generative AI could do a substantial amount of their work. Things like software developers, analysts, right? These are all jobs where we're seeing generative AI capacity increase. Now, what I would say is these numbers indicate to us that we are at a precipice. There are two future paths that lie in front of us. One is filled with worker displacement, with exploitation, with inequality, with concentrations of wealth going to people who are developing these AI models. But worker exposure to AI, does not have to mean job displacement. It can actually mean increased job satisfaction. And that is the alternative path that I would suggest we can move down, but one that is going to require intervention from the state government. So one thing to understand about these estimates, and one reason that I'm particularly concerned, is we should understand these are conservative estimates to say that a third of workers are going to be impacted. We are looking at just generative AI, so things like ChatGPT. That does not include AI that might drive cars and trucks, for example. So those who have concerns about things like Waymo, we're not talking about that here, right? This is just generative AI. The other thing to understand is that AI, of course, is rapidly advancing in its technological capacity, moving from an AI that talks to you, which is what generative AI does, responds to particular prompts, to agentic AI, which is AI that does tasks for you, where you could say, for example, go build me a website, go write really complex code for me. The AI agents go off for hours and complete these tasks and then come back to you. That is where we are headed. So if we think that AI is in a position to displace a number of workers today, I can guarantee you the number will be higher tomorrow. It's cliche to say it, but it is true. The AI we have today is the worst it will ever be. It will be better tomorrow. And if we come back next year, it will be substantially better. The current capacity of AI is doubling roughly every 7 months. That should scare you a little bit, or at least it scares me. And what we should understand in looking back is that the history of humanity is filled with these kinds of technological changes. AI is not new. It comes in the line of the agricultural revolution, the industrial revolution, the computer revolution. And in each case, in all of those revolutions, what we have seen are these moments of disruption. And in these moments of disruption, what we generally see is high levels of concentrated wealth and worker exploitation. If we want this time to be different, we have to act differently. And that means creating countervailing forces that can act back against that kind of concentrated wealth and worker exploitation. The only thing that will make AI different than past revolutionary processes is that it is going to happen faster and it may be broader. The Industrial Revolution took decades to play out. The AI revolution may be, you know, the CEO of Anthropic recently predicted that half of entry-level white-collar jobs may be gone in the next 1 to 5 years. So that is the kind of timescale that we're talking about. If we do want this time to be different, there are some things that we should be thinking about. The first is, again, making sure that there is this countervailing force that can fight back against AI exploitation and wealth concentration. And that means boosting the capacity of workers to make sure that they have a voice in how AI is implemented. And the example here that we can turn to is what happened in California a couple of years ago with the writer's strike. Now, writers of movies and film and television in Hollywood were very concerned about AI and the idea that it could put them out of a job, could just write full scripts. What they did, because they had the ability to collectively bargain over this issue, was say, we're going to be in a position to use AI, but AI cannot write full scripts and put us out of a job. The result is that writers now have more fulfilling jobs, they're more productive. That productivity means that the studios that employ them also make more money. And all of us, of course, benefit by having more television and movies that we can utilize to distract ourselves from robots coming and taking over our lives. Beyond just boosting worker power and allowing workers to have voice in AI implementation, there are three particular areas I would recommend focusing on, what I've called the three Ds of AI risk for workers. The first is digital surveillance, so making sure that workers are protected from invasive data collection, right? So making sure, for example, that AI models are not able to predict and make decisions based on somebody being pregnant, that it's not able to interfere in workers' capacity to collectively bargain, that any kind of data being collected by AI is directly related to job capacity. The second is prohibiting AI from making important employment decisions. I talked earlier about the idea of AI being able to make final hiring choices, so prohibiting that kind of use. But we've also seen AI models capable of identifying levels of consumer debt that people might be carrying, and then offering lower wages to those people who are carrying lower debt. Representative Greenman talked about surveillance pricing. We also need to be thinking about surveillance wages, which is the other side of that equation. And then finally, displacement. So preparing workers for transitions in the workplace. I think it is very unclear at this point the degree to which we are going to see displacement, but it is very possible and the scale is potentially huge. We need to be in a position where workers have advanced warning if they're going to be losing their jobs to AI, and that there are incentives in place to ensure that we have the kind of retraining and reskilling programs in place to allow for transitions to take place without widespread economic harm. So I'll close just by again saying how excited I am that this committee is taking up this issue and would welcome any questions at this time.
Thank you so much for your work and for that terrific presentation. Really helpful. We will first question from Representative Johnson W.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for the presentation. I've been fascinated with the AI discussion for a while now. And one of the questions I have is, I have like three. One of them is, we don't live in a bubble. In other words, if we, whatever restrictions we try to make on this to take care of the citizens and the workers in Minnesota, isn't what other countries would do, what other even states would do. So then how do you, while we're putting restrictions, others are moving forward to make more competitive, more productive, all and stuff like that. How do you address that?
Mr. Rosenthal.
Chair Pinto, Representative Johnson, it's a great question. And I do think in an ideal world, this would be a federal policy, right? We would love to see federal regulation to ensure that competition between states is not where we end up. With that said, I again am concerned about pitting this idea of protections and regulation against innovation. And I actually don't think we need to see these as in competition with each other. So if we look at the example of the writers in California, I think what we see there is the capacity to protect workers in a way that actually does continue to boost productivity. And I think the appropriate regulations will not necessarily scare away companies from investment here, because it will actually lead to more productive workers who really want those jobs as well, and companies who can make more money, right? And so ultimately, I think it is that kind of alignment between AI innovation and worker welfare that we should be aiming for in any regulation considered in the state.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you for that answer. One of the, I think as we move forward, I think one of the things we have to be careful of is it just reminds me back to probably late 70s, early 80s, when Japan was starting to use robots and starting to totally change how they made automobiles and everything like that. And the United States was, no, we can't do that. We're going to lose jobs and stuff like that. And what did it do to the United States? It put us in a very bad situation in the 80s, where everybody started buying Japanese cars and the auto industry really tanked as a result of it. So I just think we need to be careful about that as we move forward. But that was a statement. My last question is, as we are implementing different new worker rules, worker benefits, and using calculations of what these balances will be, how this is going to be balancing paid family, stuff like that. How are those estimates, or how can we those be accurate when you're talking about AI displacing hundreds of thousands of workers? And we've already seen that. So isn't AI making it so companies that are starting to get burdened with these costs are really going to be able to avoid all these costs just by implementing AI?
Mr. Rosenthal.
Chair Pinto, Representative Johnson, I just want to make sure that I'm understanding the question. So is it the concern that new regulations around AI use to protect workers would lead to even greater use of AI, thereby increasing the amount of displacement taking place? Am I understanding correctly?
Yeah, Representative Johnson.
Thank you. Sorry for that. No, my point is we are making employees more and more expensive. In other words, mandates on the employees, on employers, especially going the way down to examples myself. I only have a few employees, but I figured out a way that I needed one less employee because of AI. So as those expenses and those requirements and stuff like that become more and more higher, aren't we actually promoting businesses moving to AI faster and faster?
Mr. Rosenthal?
Chair Pinto, Representative Johnson, I think if we are picturing a future in which, again, we're pitting sort of AI and worker exploitation against workers having solid jobs, I'm concerned about understanding those as in opposition. I think we need to continue to think about ways in which, without these protections, we are looking at huge amounts of worker displacement taking place. What I would recommend that we be thinking about, again, having rules in place that say AI cannot make a final hiring decision. I don't see a way in which that somehow adds potential huge costs onto companies. I think that saying that AI shouldn't be able to interfere in collective bargaining decisions, I don't see how that adds huge costs onto companies. To say that workers should get some notice if AI tools are going to be used to gather their data, I think we need to also consider what it means to create a state that workers actually want to live in and work in. And that is the kind of regulation that I think this state should be looking into.
Representative Johnson. Yeah. Representative Mueller. And I will say to folks, we will need to keep moving so we can get to several other things. I know this is bringing up a lot. Representative Mueller, so we can just sort of with questions and answers, keep them short. Representative Mueller.
Thank you, Chair Pinto. And this is mostly just a comment, I think. Yeah. And as I listened to this presentation and the presentation former, this just reinforces to me why we need to make sure that agencies are working amongst each other. We are going to have to go upstream into high school to prepare people to work within AI. We are going to have to go upstream in looking at digital literacy, looking at what it's going to be to work in this new AI world. And so it is even more critical that we are making sure that our agencies, MDE, DEED, DLI, OHE, are talking to each other about what this means for our students as they continue to be prepared to work in this AI world. Thank you, Representative Pinto.
Yeah, thank you, Representative Mueller. Yeah, really important. We will, and hopefully you'll be sticking around, Mr. Rosenthal, for any further questions. Not seeing anything right at the moment. We're going to move to our next presenter. But thank you so much. That was extremely helpful. Thank you. The next presenter is joining us via Zoom. So we're going to hope that she is going to be coming up here. Do we have you with us, Samantha Gordon?
Yes. Can you hear me and see me?
Oh, there you go. Yes, we can. Excellent. So if you can identify yourself and proceed with your testimony. Thanks for being with us.
Absolutely. And I am going to share my screen so I can show you all slides. So
okay. And we do have slides as well in our packet and members of the public. These are online as well. But I will say that we can see them in the room here. So please proceed.
Great. Wonderful. Good morning. Thank you all. Thank you to the chairs and the committee for the opportunity to testify today. And I appreciate your flexibility in allowing me to join virtually. My name is Samantha Gordon, and I'm the Chief Advocacy Officer at TechEquity. We are a nonprofit based in California, and our mission is to ensure that the benefits and growth of a tech-driven economy benefit all of us. We conduct participatory research, we provide education to lawmakers and the public, and we do advocacy to ensure that new laws that are needed get passed, and when they are passed, that they are implemented well. Our work has focused on the economic intersections with technology, and that has led us to doing a lot of work on the intersection between AI and labor, which I'm thrilled that you all are talking about today and really excited to be here with you in this conversation. So I want to start with a similar theme to what the previous presenter had talked about, because we're seeing this no matter your geography or where you are across the country. At this moment, we're seeing not just energy and excitement, but also a great deal of fear and trepidation about what these changes will mean for workers, for our kids, and our future. And as was noted, poll after poll shows that Americans are concerned about the direction of this technology, where it's headed, and many are expressing skepticism that it will benefit them directly. And this is important because it creates a trust gap between users and the developers of the technology. And we believe that that trust gap actually presents an incredible opportunity for policymakers to meet this moment and help close that gap by developing a clear foundation and framework for how we engage with these tools in our day-to-day lives. So in the 20th century, obviously, after years of massive industrial expansion and concentration of resources and power into fewer and fewer hands, workers and lawmakers responded, and they set out a groundbreaking set of 20th century rights for workers, things that we all know well, right? Everything from establishing the minimum wage to ending child labor, an eight-hour workday, health and safety standards. And while these rights weren't evenly applied to all Americans, in particular, they often excluded people of color and women, they did, however, birth foundational labor standards that have guided employer behavior for the 20th century and helped also engender one of the most economically prosperous periods in our nation's history. Obviously, they were helping to ensure that workers had what they needed and not only benefited workers, but it also made companies and our entire economy more secure. And for the first time ever, as we all know, helped build a really robust middle class. So today, you know, we're actually even using the same word, but you know, as a previous presenter, but I believe we stand on a really similar precipice. We face a massive generational shift in our workplaces and our entire economy. The promise of this technology has us, you know, very excited about what comes next, and at the same time has made many people really fearful of whether or not these advancements will help or hurt them. And as was noted, polling shows that the public believes that AI is important for the nation's growth and competitiveness. But that sentiment is really shifting, right? We're seeing that in lots of activism around data centers, as was already mentioned, but other places as well. And we're seeing that, you know, 44% of Americans believe that AI could actually harm the overall economy. And 64% of Americans think that AI will lead to a loss in jobs. And those trends in this poll are not just, you know, holding across national studies or state-specific studies, but they're also really bipartisan. I know this was said before, but I just can't stress enough. There are very small differences between where Democrats are, Republicans are, and independents are when it comes to this issue. Americans are really watching this trajectory and are fearful about where we're headed. But this trend obviously is not inevitable. These gaps don't have to continue to persist. So just as we did in the 20th century, we believe this moment calls for a 21st century labor standards to meet the needs of a 21st century workplace and economy. And that requires us to just set common sense rules of the road for how employers develop and deploy this technology, and making sure that these tools create opportunities for workers rather than feeling like harbingers of doom. And often when I talk about these issues, I heard some of this, you know, in folks' questions is, you know, I get responses like, it's good to care about workers, but that's not the only thing we have to worry about. We have to make sure the business climate is strong and that firms can compete and companies are going to do what they need to make their product, to make the most sense for the company. And the beautiful thing that we're finding is that this isn't just good for workers to take on this challenge, it's also good for companies, right? There are emerging reports and studies that sort of underline that worker involvement and support is critical to ensuring the success of the technology. So you can see here on the slide a few reports that sort of underscore some of these themes or surrounded themes. So from McKinsey in last year, you know, found that AI maturity requires worker investment and input, and companies that skip this step fail to scale the technology. Similar themes in an EY study that found, you know, 15,000, it was looking at 15,000 employees across 1,500 employers, and found that, you know, nearly 9 out of 10 workers were using AI on some level at work, but only 28% of those employers were positioned to turn that deployment into high-value outcomes, and found that often when those AI tools were put into places where there was weak training or people development or culture, that productivity lagged by 40% when compared to other companies. And then finally, Stanford's AI Index, they issue this report usually every year. It documented that AI was producing measurable gains in call centers in particular in terms of productivity, but that's when the AI was being used to support the existing call center workers rather than replacing them. And this is not a new phenomenon, right? When people with frontline experience in customer service, client relations are included in the development and design of new strategies, new technologies, whatever they might be, we see gains for everyone, right? Workers often want technology to help them improve critical gaps in their work, but when the technology is designed in a way that's divorced from those workers or how the work actually happens, workers end up spending a lot of time working around technology to ensure it doesn't negatively impact their customers or the people they serve. So we think that, you know, setting these common sense guardrails can help ensure that workers are getting those rights, but also that we could unlock the promise of this technology. And as was discussed, the movement is really already underway, right? One of my main jobs here today is to help situate you in the national conversation that's happening and the context for this effort. So these are not novel ideas anymore, right? Legislators are responding to these issues in droves. In 2026, there are over 300 bills already introduced on the topic of AI and labor specifically around the country. And when you look at the broader field of AI legislation, which I do a lot of work here in California on a lot of different issues on AI, and there are thousands of bills moving across the country, and we're not even all the way through Q1 of 2026. There's also, I just want to note, and I'm happy to share this with folks afterwards, a really strong inventory of all the current bills moving across the country at the AI and labor intersection that's hosted at the University of California, Berkeley's Labor Center. And it includes a roundup across key categories, and I will pull somewhat from there. But if you have questions about specific bills or want to look at specific examples, it's a great resource to reference. So what are we seeing? So there's really sort of three key areas we're seeing in this space. And depending on how you group them, I know the previous presenter had kind of a different way of grouping them, but they're similar themes. So first is algorithmic management, then electronic monitoring, and human in the loop. And obviously there's a ton of activity going on when it comes to data privacy, discrimination, and those are, you know, intersecting issues with workers and labor. And there's a lot of new and emerging conversations happening about job displacement, which I will touch on briefly. So first, when we think of algorithmic management, this covers employers' use of digital technologies to make decisions about workers. So things like using AI to determine wages, schedules, job responsibilities, sometimes being using AI to determine discipline or termination. So there are a lot of bills moving on this. Some of the landmark proposals are in California, there's a bill called the No Robo Bosses Act, and in Massachusetts, there's the FAIR Act, both of which would establish transparency requirements. They would set some prohibitions on the most harmful uses and responsible use guardrails. There are similar bills moving in Vermont, Washington. Colorado has a broader kind of AI framework, which includes some of these rights in the employment context. But none of the most comprehensive versions have passed. But there's obviously a lot of energy around these policies and is responding to what we're seeing in the polling and what workers are asking for. Second is electronic monitoring. So this covers kind of the full range of surveillance that we see in workplaces that's becoming pretty common. So things like keystroke logging, location tracking, productivity scoring, AI-enabled monitoring of messages and video, things like that. The leading approaches require employers to give workers advance notice of what's being tracked, to limit how that data can be used against workers, and establish meaningful consent standards. There are bills in New York, Connecticut, and Delaware that have passed that create notice rights. And some of the more comprehensive and stronger bills are moving right now in California, Massachusetts, and Washington. And those would go further in adding responsible use requirements beyond the notice. And then the final category I just want to touch on is human in the loop. So this is about ensuring that a real accountable human is meaningfully involved before an algorithm drives a consequential decision about a worker's livelihood. And I think the important operative word here is meaningful. We're seeing examples and research coming out that, you know, people are clicking through approvals and on average a doctor might be reviewing a claim and spend 1.2 seconds on that claim, right? So we want to make sure that the human in the loop is not just kind of a rubber stamp or sort of machine bias, but is really meaningful and gives them the time and space to review decisions that might be complex. And we've seen this enacted in the health insurance context in Maryland, Nebraska, and Texas. And there's also a strong example, obviously not passed because it's in Congress and things don't tend to pass there, as we all know, but the Federal Right to Override Act, which requires human in the loop that would allow healthcare workers in particular to override an algorithm if doing so is in the best interest of the patient. So I heard this mentioned earlier around nurses wanting to make sure that they have the ability, you know, to use their professional judgment. So that's kind of what this bill centers on. And it would prohibit the ability for businesses to retaliate against workers if they are overriding an algorithmic decision for the best interest of the patient, and would ensure workers can provide feedback on algorithms that are exhibiting bias or inaccuracies or that are constantly requiring an override. And then thinking about job displacement. So I think this is a big area of fear. It's a big topic of discussion. And there has been a lot of research issued. But the truth is that we don't actually yet have the data to fully understand the scale of what's happening and what might be in store for workers for moving forward. There's a lot of proclamations and a lot of fear, but the data, the sort of public government-owned data of what's actually happening in the workplace is not fully to scale yet. But because there's a lot of fear about this and a lot of energy and wanting to make sure we get in front of this and that we're not just sitting with a crisis in a year or two, we're seeing a lot of public policy energy in this direction. And there's really sort of three types of displacement bills that we see moving. First is efforts to protect workers directly from automation and job loss. So these tend to be sector-specific approaches. For example, Illinois Governor Pritzker signed last year a bill that would prohibit AI from being used in place of a mental health professional. There are a lot of efforts being put in place to make sure a human driver is in the cab if there's autonomous vehicles in truck driving, things like that.
And Ms. Randall, we'll need to have you wrap up in just a minute.
Oh, sure. Yeah,
thank you so much.
Of course, I will move quickly through. So the other examples are protecting workers from being forced to train their AI replacement and education and training, right? We see this a lot, but we think those three pieces have to really go together. And the last piece I just want to touch on before wrapping is this argument around innovation versus regulation. And I would just echo that these two things fit together. We think a good example of this is seatbelts, where there was, you know, a state-by-state effort to require that seatbelts were passed. And then once those states had passed an overwhelming number, I believe 28, it became a federal standard. And 90% of Americans were using seatbelts, saving 15,000 lives a year. The part that's important about this, I think, is that the arguments at the time, right, were that that would actually slow auto sales, that it would, you know, change the look of cars, that this was a mass hysteria created by a corporate controlled media. And we see similar arguments playing out today, right, of not wanting to set regulations around the use of this technology because it could slow innovation or it could, you know, move that energy overseas. And this is something that's happened over and over again as new waves of innovation have happened. And so I say all of that to say that, you know, this is not a new conversation. These sorts of guardrails actually, we believe, would set a common sense framework and a foundation for unlocking the potential innovation of this technology. So I will just close by underscoring that we are at an inflection point and that decisions made in the bodies like this one are critical and help actually determine if this innovation and this promise of this technology is broadly beneficial And wanting to make sure that, you know, we don't continue with sort of the wild, wild west of how this shows up in our daily lives, and encourage you all to consider a 21st century set of labor standards that wouldn't slow this technology down per se, but about making sure that it works for everyday people. So thank you all for the time, and I will stop there.
Thank you so much. Very helpful presentation. Members, I'm thinking that what we'll do is we have three sets of proposed legislative language before us, all authored by Representative Godfrey. And I'm thinking that we'll have him present about these three because they kind of reflect points made by each of the last two presenters. And so we can learn about some of his ideas. This is just a discussion. I will note the first bill listed on the agenda is actually in our committee's possession. I believe it's House File 4093. But this is just information. We'll have a conversation. So we'll have Representative Godfrey present on the three bills, and then we will move. I'm sorry, 4369. Wrong bill number. Thank you. 4369. 4093 might be one coming up tomorrow. Maybe that was in my head. And then we have a conversation. Hopefully, Ms. Gordon, you can stick around for questions may come up after the bills. So, Representative Godfrey, if you can describe the three bills, and members, these are in your packets, and members of the public, these are online as well. Representative Godfrey.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. And I think the presentations that we just heard today really provided a fantastic overview of both the opportunities that we saw with the University of Minnesota and some of the challenges that artificial intelligence really, you know, poses to our economy and our workforce. You know, we've already seen how AI has changed many, many facets of our economy. And as has been discussed, many are drawn to the promise of improving lives, but others are really fearful of some of the negative impacts it could have on employment, wealth disparity, and the environment. People like me really experience both of these things and hold them both to be true. And, you know, as technology advances, to me, it's vital to center the voices of people that are going to be using these technologies every day, especially our workers. And so I just, you know, as I was thinking about these bills, I thought to myself, we don't really have to look terribly far back to see kind of the danger of a careless deployment of new technologies. You know, if you look back at, you know, largely unchecked social media has made people more divided than we've ever been before, really has shortened our attention spans, and really blasted us with disinformation. And so, you know, at this moment, I keep asking myself, how do we proactively ensure that AI is used as a tool for good, as opposed to as a weapon for ill? And so the three bills that I am starting the conversation around today really, really do seek to set and establish that labor rights standard for the 21st century and this really, really new, exciting technology that we have before us. You know, these bills do this by what I would call mitigating AI's potential worst impacts on workers, with the hope that we can really then pivot to becoming leaders in the responsible and ethical development of artificial intelligence within our state. You know, as indicated in the North Star Policies Report, and I believe it was discussed by Sam Gordon as well, workers face potentially life-altering job displacement due to the deployment of AI in their workplace. And so House File 4369 makes possible a just transition to a new or continued employment by requiring notice before implementing a technology that could displace jobs. The employer provides a transitional employment period during which they offer their employees the opportunity to retrain or reskill or upskill, as it was a phrase used by the University of Minnesota, so that they can more easily obtain another another job, or in an ideal circumstance, remain employed in the same place but in a different capacity with new skills. The second and third bills are pretty closely related. They pertain to the electronic monitoring systems and automated decision systems, both of which were kind of addressed throughout the second two presentations. Each bill establishes a pre- and post-use notification for these technologies if they are used to make a substantive decision about a worker's employment status. Each bill also establishes a worker's right to appeal or right to access, the data about them and to appeal a decision that was made using that data if they think that data was inaccurate or erroneous. They also established some prohibited and accepted uses of each technology. And I will say, just as a side note, the past couple of weeks, I've really had some really phenomenal conversations with many members of this committee. And I think in these conversations, we've found large agreement in the concepts that underpin these bills. And I've also been pleased to learn that I have found that some employers are already practicing some of the things that are touched on in this bill, which is great. That is exactly the sort of ethical use of artificial intelligence within the workforce that I'd hoped for. However, our goal with any piece of legislation like this isn't to catch the good actors, it's to protect against the bad and irresponsible ones. And so that's really the goal of these three pieces of legislation right here. And I, at this point, you know, I welcome questions, I welcome feedback, I welcome a discussion. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Representative Gottfried. Yeah, and I'll note that your three bills kind of line up with the three Ds in the presentation, Mr. Rosenthal, and certainly line up a lot with what we heard from Ms. Gordon. And Melissa Heising, we'll have to testify, if you can, keep it fairly short. So glad to have you with us, though. Proceed.
Thank you. Good morning, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Melissa Heising, and I'm Legislative Director of the Minnesota AFL-CIO, the state's voluntary democratic labor federation, representing unions in the public sector, private sector, and building trades across the state. I want to thank Representative Gottfried for his leadership in authoring these bills. They're an important step towards common sense regulation of how AI is used in the workplace and its impact on workers. And then I'm going to make some comments on each of the bills. So first of all, the automated decision systems bill. We appreciate the strong foundation this proposal establishes to regulate automated decision systems in the workplace. This bill includes critical protections, advance notice to workers, limits on algorithmic wages, strong appeal rights, and clear prohibitions on using these systems to violate labor, civil rights, or safety laws. Those are important steps. However, to ensure the systems are truly accountable, we encourage that it should require impact assessments, not just disclosure, to evaluate accuracy, bias, disparate impacts, and risks to worker rights before systems are deployed. These assessments should include independent third-party review, regular updates, and a cease use requirement if discriminatory outcomes are found. The bill should also include anti-retaliation protections for workers who raise concerns or refuse to follow the output of an automated decision-making system when the worker believes in good faith that the output would cause harm, discrimination, or otherwise violate law or professional licensing requirements.
And by the way, we'll have to have you, this is information only, probably have to have you cut it just
very
short.
Okay.
I'm so sorry.
Right.
Yeah.
Overall, we just think, you know, if there's one thing you take away from my testimony, just that working people, as has been stated by other testifiers, working people are the experts on how to do their jobs well and safely, and they must have a voice in how AI is used in the workplace. Thank you.
Ms. Heising, thank you so much. I'm sorry to keep it short, and we'll certainly, if and as the bills are coming back up, we want to have full testimony on them. And members, we'll have to end a couple minutes early because rules is going to be in here. We have a few minutes to discuss. Representative Green, it looked like maybe you had something, but maybe not. Okay, Representative, well, we'll see. Maybe there's not. Members, any questions or discussion necessary? Chair Baker, to you.
Mr. Chair, I just wasn't sure to Representative Gottfried. Are we talking about the other bills quickly too, or just kind of the general theme?
I think he actually talked about all three together.
Yeah.
Okay. So he did discuss briefly, walk through each of them.
Thank you. Okay. Yeah. And again, thanks for bringing this. Again, this was a very interesting day today, talking and listening to the reality of where we're at here in Minnesota. Again, I think from starting out with the university and kind of hearing their AI hub model that they're just exploring and launching now, to the good conversations we have to protect our workers, but also to protect our businesses. Because right now the reality is we want to stay competitive in the market. We want to make sure our employees are happy and well paid. I don't think there's an employer out there that wants to literally kind of remove them just for the sake of removing them. But right now the problem that we're having is we have very high vacancy rates. And that's something that has been driven by a lot of different variables, a lot of different things. And so what's forcing, I think, some of these decisions to get made or pushed along is we have to make sure that we have that balance. If we work together, and thank you for reaching out to me earlier, too, on this idea, and I think that as we continue our journey as legislators and lawmakers, we need to make sure that if we have our own AI hub or we want to maybe partner with the university and having conversations, we need to make sure we pull together a very bipartisan, very balanced approach to this, because it doesn't work if it's heavy one way or the other. It's got to be all eyes on it. So, again, I look forward to further conversations. Mr. Chair, thanks for bringing this up today. But this is an important discussion that we are going to have a lot of time in the future, legislators, to talk about this with time. So thank you.
Thank you, Chair Baker. We'll see if others. I mean, I will say to a certain extent we have a lot of time, and AI is doubling in capacity every 7 months. So to the extent that these bills end up being considered, if they end up not being considered till next year, then AI will have quadrupled in power. So everything that can be done now will be four times more powerful and more than that in 12 months, in 14 months. So recognizing that.
And to that, Mr. Chair, if I just may reply to that, you're right. It's moving very, very fast. But also I've seen fast legislation go wrong if we don't get it right. Because, again, I'm not saying we can slow down AI. We can't do that. But I want to make sure that we do this in a way that isn't going to make bad decisions and put us in a negative place in the future growth of Minnesota jobs. So we just want to make sure I have the time.
Thank you, Chair Baker. And I will note, this is an informational hearing on these three bills. We're certainly not rushing anything through. I know that Representative Gottfried, though, is quite eager to talk to folks about the details of these bills. So I will say, if you have any interest at all, please talk with him. It's possible we bring these bills back up and would seek a vote this session. Again, if we don't wait till next session, then we know we're going to be dealing with four times the issue to a certain extent. I will note both Democratic and Republican support for action on this. And just I'm looking at the University of St. Thomas document, a very significant proportion of Minnesota workers are at significant risk here. So we deliberately were not pushing through on a vote today, but we do want to make sure that we dive into these bills and into these issues. So see if anybody has anything else that they wish to say. Representative Greenman, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Gottfried. I really appreciate, especially after hearing this whole conversation, the approach and really the effort to dive into and ensure that the public and the people that we represent are at the table and are helping to set some rules and guidelines. And I agree with Representative Baker, we have to get this right. I also know if we don't do anything, these decisions are being made without the public, without people, without small businesses, without all the folks who represent at the table. So not doing anything is not going to create a better, more equitable, more ethical position. It will actually be worse. And so I think that the urgency that Representative Pinto described of the technology is advancing very quickly. Right now, we know that this is being developed in secret in most cases and for profit. And so as we think about some of the testimony we heard, thinking about how we protect the public interest is our job here. And I really appreciate this effort of specifically thinking about the workforce with this committee should be focused on, as well as the economic development piece. So thank you.
And I might ask before turning to Representative Gottfried whether there is a GOP member with an interest in working with Representative Gottfried on this. I know he'd be very interested in that. I won't put folks on the spot necessarily, but if there is somebody, Representative Schultz, are you've taken that on, Representative Schultz?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I do have an interest in it. I've spoken with Representative Gottfried.
Good stuff.
At least in minor form at this point, and just continue a good conversation because of all topics out there in the world right now, it's incredibly important that we at least measure twice before cutting once on this topic. Thank you.
Absolutely. Thank you, Representative Schultz. Yeah, and actually you were the one who brought up AI at the last hearing, and so much appreciating that. So good. Well, this will be a nice thing. So Representative Gottfried, you get the final word on your three bills.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you everyone in the presenters today for a really, really vibrant discussion. And I know, thank you, Representative Schultz, for working on this down the road. I know in our conversation, we really did talk about how this could be a huge, huge productivity boost for workers. And again, I think that's what we're all trying to go for. You know, I think we're really trying to make sure that this is a technology that is used to grow our economy in a way that really benefits everybody. And that's the honest faith attempt that I'm going for here. One of the things that we try to do in this is try to not regulate the technology itself, but try to put guardrails around the use cases, like how these things are used on the people that use them. And so, you know, I would just echo what I think was said by all three presenters in one way, shape, or form, is that putting up some common sense guardrails about how these technologies are used in the employer-employee relationship is not going to be harmful to innovation, because we are still going to be able to find ways to really, really boost productivity, really be able to use this as an additive to the workforce, to our economy, even with some of these guardrails around that employer-employee relationship. So I thank everyone here today for the opportunity to talk about this, start the conversation, and I very, very much look forward to continuing that conversation. So thank you, Mr. Chair, Chair Pinto, Chair Baker, and members of the committee for hearing us out today. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Yeah, and again, we're taking step by step, so these bills were not officially before us, so no need to take further action at the moment. Chair Baker, preview for tomorrow.
Very quickly, Mr. Chairman, we have a couple of bills in front of us tomorrow, members. I'd like to bring an idea about how we can move towards a little different way of looking at our direct appropriations versus more towards competitive grants. I know this is one that we're going to get along with, I think, pretty well. A VRS fix, vocational rehab, but we have to look at. And a very small discussion about paid family medical leave, how it affects very small sub-S companies that are ownership. And I just want to explain that to the team tomorrow. And finally, today is Shamrock Day, 2:00 in the vault. I want to make sure I just put a shout out. Our staff is all welcome as well. And I want to thank the partners for doing that as well. So that's it, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Chair Baker. Yes, a very happy St. Patrick's Day to all. And with that, the meeting is adjourned.